Listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio AM 820 brings you Foundations in Faith. Join Monsignor Frank Lane as he offers insights into the readings heard at Mass. And now, Foundations in Faith with Monsignor Frank Lane.
This is Father Frank Lane, and we're continuing our program, Foundations in Faith. Today, we're going to look at the Gospel according to St. Mark, chapter 10, verses 46 to 52. It's Mark's version of the story of the healing of the blind man named Bartimaeus. And there's all sorts of different kinds of pieces to this particular story and this particular healing miracle. The first thing that I think that is important for us to do is to remember that there is outlined in the prophecies of Isaiah some interior descriptions, as it were, of who the Messiah is going to be. And in chapter 61 of Isaiah, there is the prescription that, you know, the Holy One is going to cure the blind, let the blind see. So we see throughout the Gospels, especially in the miracle stories, the fulfillment of prophecy. And this brings us into a kind of an important piece of our tradition, of our history, and something that helps us to understand more deeply the unfolding of the Christian mystery in every age. We have a struggle in many, many ages as what does it mean for the Christian faith to develop? What does it mean for the Christian faith to kind of be expanded in its comprehension? We have two very, very diverse trajectories in this kind of argumentation. And one of them is that Christian revelation changes as the ages go on, and that it is kind of incarnate, embedded in human culture, human understanding. And so the culture has the freedom to reinterpret it according to what it considers and perceives to be the basic needs of every age. One of the great leaders in this movement, in the modern movement of this idea of developing revelation, was a Christian brother by the name of Gabriel Moran. He wrote a number of texts on revelation, and basically rejected the traditional Christian tradition that the fullness of revelation had been given to the apostles, and deposited in with the church, and is reflected upon and interpreted through the common experience of the church, which we call tradition, entrusted to the magisterial authority of the apostolic successors. That's the traditional notion of how revelation passes through the ages. It's very consistent, for instance, with the first real treatise on the development of doctrine by Vincent of Lerins in the 5th century. Vincent of Lerins was a monk that lived on the island of Loran on the south of France. I think today it's called Saint-Honorat. And it was a monastery established in the spirit of John Cassian, and therefore had with it a great deal of the Eastern traditions embedded in it. It's interesting that's where St. Patrick went in his preparation for priesthood and episcopacy, so that when he came back to Ireland, he brought with him many of the traditions of the East, which is very unusual that the most Western outpost of Europe became kind of where Eastern traditions were woven into the Western, to Latin Christianity. But whatever, Vincent wrote a treatise on the development of doctrine, and he compared it to the growth of a child. And he said, you know, the child, the person who the child is, never disappears, that even though the body change and grow, and he uses this example that an old man is still, in some sense, the child that he once was. He is the same person. And so he says, and it becomes very much a part of, he's articulating, he's not creating a teaching, he's articulating a sense within the church in the ages that comes right out of the ages of the great Christological councils of the first few centuries of the church, in which it was hammered out how we are to discuss and how we are to talk about the biblical phenomenon of the proclamation of the incarnation of the Son of God as both God and man, and the affirmation of that finally in the Council of Ephesus of 451, I believe, in which the doctrine of Theotokos is defined, and the Theotokos means God bearer, which means that Jesus is not split in two, but Mary is the mother of the whole Christ, and therefore also the mother of God. So out of this milieu of these discussions of the early Christological councils, Vincent of Lauran is able to articulate their understanding of the development of doctrine, which he, again, which he compares to the life of a human person. The person doesn't change, but they grow and expand, and the core remains essentially true. Gabriel Moran in the 1960s rejected that and set in motion this whole catechetical movement, which kind of rejected the whole body of Catholic teaching and tried to recreate from scratch some kind of ethical system of you know, be nice, of, you know, love your neighbor, and develop the whole kind of notion that Christianity is nothing more than basically an ethical system, that we come to realize its importance in a different way in every age. They're radically different. And I suppose in the interpretation of the Second Vatican Council, it also is reflected in this argument. Is the Council in continuity with the teaching of the Church, or is it a rupture? In the traditional understanding of the Church itself, if it is a rupture, it is no longer the Catholic Church. And Pope Benedict XVI was very adamant about that. But we see the disciples of rupture and the disciples of Moran's understanding of Revelation, and we have legitimately can ask, is this still the Catholic Church? And so these are the great debates of the modern age. But the fact of the matter is that in the early Church, in the fathers of the Church, this whole problem of the development of doctrine was seen in a different kind of a context that Louis Bouilhet talks about as basically a mystical context. And that doesn't mean visions and ecstasies and all of that kind of thing. It means basically the word is derived from a word that means secret or told but not spoken. And basically the theory of the early Church Fathers is that underneath that which we see, there is always another reality, another presence. And that, for instance, the fulfillment of the Old Testament, it's not able to be completely understood until the coming of Christ, because Christ is the secret of the Old Testament. And I think that Christ himself affirms that in the story of the road to Emmaus, when he quotes the scriptures to the two companions he's walking with, all of the places in which the law and the prophets had referred to him. The scriptures, obviously, that Jesus was using was not the New Testament, but the Hebrew scriptures, the Old Testament. From that particular understanding that Jesus reveals himself through the Old Testament, the fathers of the Church then began to say the Old Testament is authentically interpreted only through the person of Christ. Obviously, the Jews would object to this, and obviously, when Pope Benedict said something like this not so long ago, there was a great furor about his anti-Semitism, which is, of course, absolutely absurd. But it's just another part of the political hackness, I suppose we could say, of modern discourse, that the fathers saw it as such. They also saw not only the Old Testament as being kind of the mystical, the revealing of the secret of Jesus, revealed throughout the ages but not grasped, seen, or understood, and they apply that also to the sacramental life of the Church, calling therefore the whole life of the Church a mystical reality. The secret underlying the sacraments is the real presence of Christ, and so forth. So this is all part of and parcel of when we find in the New Testament these kinds of realities that hearken back to the Old Testament. When we see these, then what happens is we enter into this mindset of the fathers of the Church, this mindset even of Jesus at Emmaus, and we begin to see then the fulfillment of prophecy in the life of the Lord. The evangelists are probably very aware of that. No one can go back and say, well, this is what they tried to do or wanted to do. In this recording of in Mark's Gospel of the curing of Bartimaeus, the blind man, does Mark have deeply in his mind the 61st chapter of Isaiah, or is he simply recounting an event that was witnessed by a believing crowd? And we can say either. However, in the final analysis, it is a fulfillment of Isaiah, whether Mark so designates it or not, because it's one of the marks of the Messiah. And usually in the New Testament, when Jesus is the Messiah, it is seen as or understood as the Messiah, it is usually in the context of some Old Testament prophecy. And that it is somewhere other the fulfillment of the covenant, the fulfillment of God's relationship with his people. This is the Christian teaching and the ethos. It is not anti-Semitic. It is not anti-Jewish. It honors, in fact, the whole Jewish tradition as that from which we understand ourselves. And so there is a harmony between the Old and the New Testament, and there is need not be conflict and acrimony. We see that very clearly in the story of the Visitation, when the Ark of the New Covenant, Mary carrying the Messiah, meets the Ark of the Old Covenant carrying the final prophet, and it is a joyous and loving occasion. The encounter of the Hebrew Scriptures and the New Testament is a joyous and a loving occasion. If the Hebrews do not want to come into what we see as fulfillment, that is not a judgment on them. It is, in a sense, an understanding that they preserve the fonts from our point of view. And to have that point of view is in no way, shape, or form an offense against anyone. So, when we look at this story then, and we come to the story of Bartimaeus, we see that Jesus is leaving Jericho. And as he is leaving Jericho with a large crowd, there is sitting at the side of the road, and what happens at the side of the road, on the road from Jericho to Jerusalem, which is a pilgrim path for people heading, especially at Passover time, to the temple, that's where the beggars gather. Many of the beggars are either in some way physically disabled. Many of the blind, they have no other way to earn a living except begging. And so they're going to go along the highly traveled routes where there's many, many people walking, many pilgrims on their way, and very much a part of Hebrew piety was giving alms to the poor. So here is a blind man and is the crowd, and it says Jesus is leaving with his disciples and a large crowd, so it's an opportune time for those who are begging at the gate, the Jerusalem gate coming out of Jericho. It is an opportune time for them to beg for money. However, there is one there who hears that it is Jesus of Nazareth. He begs for something different. He cries out to him, Son of David, have pity on me. Son of David, Jesus, have pity on me. It's a title that he doesn't use very often himself because it carries with it connotations of messianic expectations that have to do with the political and sociological structure of Israel, which is not anything that he seems to have any great particular interest in. Which is kind of why it's kind of interesting in kind of the Marxian theory of contemporary Western politics, that politics somehow or other is almost a religion and practice of it the highest of virtues. This is foreign and alien, of course, to the New Testament, and foreign and alien, of course, to the life of Jesus. So as he's going out, Son of David, Jesus, have pity on me. It means that Bartimaeus is familiar with the messianic expectations of the popular notions of Israel, and that he uses it as a title of respect. And so he began to shout and to say, and many in the crowd scolded him and told him to keep quiet. But he only shouted all the louder. Someone is trying to get Jesus' attention, and it happens so often. Let's try and protect, you know, the messengers of the gospel. No, the messengers of the gospel should be vulnerable to the crowds of every age, including our own, certainly. Certainly, I know that, for instance, during this whole sex abuse thing, there was great this great anxiety among the priests. Who am I going to be accused? Am I going to be accused falsely? If I do, I have no alternative. I have no defense. Accusation, we are not protected by civil law, actually. That accusation is conviction. And many see that as a reason for upset and anger, but I think it's part of the nature of the priesthood. The crowds do in fact tend to take out their anger on those who bear the name of Christ. And if we happen to be the objects of that, and if a certain percentage of us within the priesthood have so legitimated that anger, it is simply something we have to bear in the name of Christ, and let things happen that happen, and believe deeply in the love of Jesus Christ for us and for his people and for his church. So Jesus stopped, though, and said when this man was calling to him, he stopped and said, "Call him here." So they called the blind man. "Courage," they said, "get up, he is calling you." Everything changes when Jesus notices the blind man calling to him. And the crowd's attitude also changes from one of be quiet and keep away from him and don't bother him and don't be annoying to, all right, he's called your name now, take courage and get up, for he's calling you. So Bartimaeus, throwing off his cloak, jumped up and went to Jesus. So he is anxious and he is enthusiastic about this encounter with the Lord. And then Jesus spoke, "What do you want me to do for you?" And then he calls him Rabboni. He calls him therefore teacher. And he says to him, Master, let me see again. He is heaping upon Jesus messianic titles of a sort. Rabboni is the very word that Mary Magdalene uses in the garden when she recognizes Jesus as risen. That is teacher. Teacher was one of the, for instance, Qumran expectations of who the Messiah would be, the teacher of righteousness and the teacher of light. And so Jesus looks at him and says, "Go, your faith has saved you." And his belief in the messiahship of Jesus has caused him to be cured. And immediately his sight returned and he followed him along the road. We know, for instance, in John's gospel that there's an extension of this gospel where, in fact, the Pharisees and the chief priests and the scribes and so forth try to debunk the story of Bartimaeus, try to debunk the story of his being healed of blindness and so forth. But here it simply ends with the cure, with the miracle. And we go back then once again to this which we have talked about so often, the very notion of miracle. The miracle is not in some way, shape, or form a deus ex machina kind of event. It's not God all of a sudden deciding to plunge his finger into the created order and change the order of nature. That is a completely false understanding of miracle. It's an understanding that in the catechetical world back in the late 60s, when it all started to change in the 70s and 80s, even the 90s, somehow or other, biblical scholars could not accept the fact of God intervening in nature. And so they came up with all sorts of explanations for all sorts of things. Demonically possessed or epileptic, the Red Sea was really the Sea of Reeds, and the Scirocco winds came and dried it up, and all of these other things, which demand more credulity than the miracle story itself. Nevertheless, the miracles, in fact, did happen, and they are not what the popular mind interprets them to be. Because if we go back into the book of Genesis, we see that God created the world and everything he created. And it ends with the verse, God saw that it was good. The Hebrews are very well aware of the fact, as they look around the world in which they live, not everything is good. Humanity is not necessarily always good. There's all sorts of terrifying events that come to us from the created order, earthquakes and hurricanes and typhoons and heat waves and flooding and all of those kinds of things, part of the ebb and the flow of the created world. And they were able to say, for instance, they were not able to say, well, this is what God intended, because he intended only good. And so basically they then situated the whole disorder, not only of the human person, but of nature itself, around the notion of human sinfulness. And that therefore nature that God created and saw was good is radically altered by the sinfulness of humanity. And I think, you know, we can actually see this in a certain way. For instance, we can see kind of the raping of the forests and the lands and so forth, the complete disregard for the order of nature, something that comes to us from the mechanistic age of Descartes and Newton, but nevertheless, where nature itself is not a living reality, that is simply an inanimate object and that we can do with as we please. There was in medieval Christianity certainly a harmony between the movements of nature and the movements of liturgical year of the church. We see it in the Ember Days, and we saw it in the blessing of fields and the processions of saints to the fields, and we see it in the, you know, in the coming of winter and the dawning of spring, and the liturgy flowed back and forth in accord with the rhythm of nature and of humanity's engagement in nature and so forth. But after, in the Enlightenment, with the age of the mechanism, with the age of the proclamation of nature as being an inanimate object, by creatures like Descartes and Newton, what happened then was is that we began to exploit and destroy the environment. That certainly means there is a disharmony. It isn't God who strips the land. It isn't God who creates the deserts because we have abused the land. It isn't God who allows mudslides because we have been inattentive and unappreciative of the contours of nature and so forth. It is humanity in its thoughtlessness and in its greed. And it's no particular economic structure that does that either. So this whole idea that somehow or other there is bound to Christian morality a particular structure, political or economic structure, is not necessarily true. But that's the kind of way that nature has been disrupted, not only that, but of course in the darkness that we see in the human heart. So that when Jesus heals, when Jesus creates a miracle that reverses what seems to be a natural phenomenon, blindness, lameness, all of this kind of thing, natural disasters and all of this, he is not interfering in nature at all. He is pushing back human sinfulness, that the goodness that God created in the first place in an orderly way should come back into view and reside in the lives of those people who call upon him and those people who witness what he does. So he does not interfere in nature. He interferes in the sinful structures of humanity in order that nature might be revealed as what God intended it to be. Every miracle is therefore a moment of revelation, of two things: the authorship of creation and the presence of the author of creation in the person of Jesus of Nazareth. These are the two things: the divinity of Christ, the human being, and also the goodness of the created order as it was intended originally by God. That's what a miracle is. And so when we go back then into the Old Testament and we go back then into the prophecies of Isaiah and we see somehow or other the coming of the day of the Lord is kind of a restoration of natural harmony. The lamb will lie down with the lion and the child shall put his hand in the adder's lair. There will be plenty. There will be a feast on my mountain. There will be plenty of food, all of that kind of stuff. Nature, as created by God, is good, is restored on the day of the Lord, according to the prophecies of Isaiah. And so what these are sparks of the fulfillment of the prophecy scattered throughout the New Testament. Sparks of the fulfillment of the prophecy of the restoration of the created order by on the day of the Lord. And that this becomes for us then an insight into the meaning and the hope of the people of the Old Testament, of the prophecies of the Old Testament. and that they show themselves here. This story of Bartimaeus is therefore the breaking through into the New Testament of the secret of the Old Testament, the revelation of God and the revelation of the goodness of creation, the revelation of order, the revelation of all those things which humanity hopes for. Jesus, in his power as the divine Son, restores that created order by pushing back the sinful structures of humanity which have caused it. When we come into the encounter later on with the blind man, we do realize sin is the result of the disfiguration of nature. So they want to go back and say, so you must have sinned, which is contrary to their own tradition and has nothing to do with that. Personal sin certainly contributes to the weight of sinfulness, but it is not individually causally responsible for the misfortunes of life. And that you can have misfortunes befall very virtuous people. That is not a sign of God's displeasure or punishment for personal or individual sin. All human sin contributes to the sinfulness of the world, but there is no causal relationship between individual sin and the vagaries of the natural order, unless those sins are blatant. If someone strips their land and there's a flood on the land, yeah, it's their fault. But in most of the things that we're speaking about in the Gospels, those are not the issues that are taking place. And so this man who has the courage and the faith to say, Son of David, Jesus, have pity on me, and then ask for a cure, is the sign of the believer, the one who is so steeped in the hopes and the promises of the Old Testament, and see in Jesus its fulfillment, that they dare call out to him in the midst of the crowd and ask for the great favor of the miracle of the revelation of the good order of creation and the presence of God among us, of Emmanuel. Let us echo then the call of the blind man, honor Jesus with his title as Messiah, Lord, and King, and beseech him in our own way to perform the miracles of healing in the world in which we live.
Foundations in Faith is a production of listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820. Archives of Foundations in Faith are available at stgabrielradio.com. Veni, so